Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Peace Talk. Peace Talk is produced by Juno's chapter of Veterans for Peace, and it's our way of conveying to the wonderful people of Juno some thinking and thoughts about the way we spend our money and certain programs that help people and lead toward a realization of the dream of peace. Today has been quite a day. We have had this terrible tragedy in Boston. They're still trying to sort out what happened there. And we also, of course, paid our taxes today, or we better have paid our taxes or filed an extension. And we also understand that it is Patriots Day in Boston, which was a way of recognizing Boston as the roots of our democracy and the roots of our government. And it was sullied so terribly today that it took a little bit of the joy of springtime out of the air, here, even as far away as here in Juneau. But we won't dwell on that. We will go ahead with the program as planned. A couple of very interesting guests with us this evening. We're going to have Michelle Kinyukin, and we're going to have Brian Doherty and Hattie from Lebanon, Hattie Kanes. You can correct me later, guys. Anyway, I apologize for mispronouncing names. But Hattie, you're on right now, right? Hattie?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you are on. I told you I got names screwed up. I was calling for Michelle.
Yes.
Hi, Michelle. How are you this evening?
Hi, Phil. I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay. Well, we're talking with you particularly because your chapter of Veterans for Peace in Seattle today, we're handing out leaflets, little sort of poster informational items prepared by the War Resisters League. And they have to do on this tax day with where our tax dollars are spent by our federal government.
Yep.
And you passed out a little chart and explanation from the War Resisters League. And if you'd like to, could you just tell us what this thing provides as information?
Sure. Well, it's a double-sided letter-sized leaflet, full color, and as you said, it's from the War Resisters League, and it's called "Where Your Income Tax Money Really Goes." And the purpose of the leaflet is to show folks, give them an idea of, you know, as on tax day, as they're thinking about taxes, where what that money is being spent on by the federal government. And this year, the War Resisters League updates it every year. This year, based on fiscal year 2014 projections, it shows that $567 billion will go to past military spending, that's veterans benefits and interest on the national debt. That's 20% of the budget. And then, or 20% rather of the total outlays. And then 27% will go to the current military spending, that's $767 billion. So, it's almost half of it. So 47%. Is spent on past or current military spending.
And that's of the entire federal budget.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the other, just for curiosity's sake, what are the other percentages for the other areas?
Well, the chart shows 43% on human resources, and that's money that's spent to Health and Human Services, Social Security Administration, the Education Department, Housing and Urban Development, things like that, earned income or child credits. So that's $1.245 trillion goes to that section of it, 43%. and then 6% goes to what they call general government. It's spent to the Treasury Department, including a 20% interest on the debt, not including the interest paid on the debt for military spending, of course. Government personnel, the Justice Department, part of the funding for the State Department, NASA, and some other departments, such as the judicial branch and the legislative. And then the last piece of the budget pie is 5% for physical resources, and that's $135 billion. It goes to agriculture, Interior Department, transportation. Some of the money they count towards Homeland Security that isn't spent on how they break it out in military spending. HUD, Commerce Department, non-military energy department spending, and a number of other departments, such as those in the Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera.
Wow. So that's a pretty huge outlay and a monstrous outlay for the military.
And it's kind of striking because, you know, what's kind of neat about this leaflet is the War Resisters League shows you the chart that the government shows when you get your 1040 instruction, because they have a chart on that document too to show what their version of it is, and the way that they come up with a different figure is they use funds that aren't income tax funds. So Social Security spending is brought in there to boost it. So trust fund things like, you know, Social Security and some of the Medicare stuff that you don't pay in all of it or even part of it in your income tax. So the retirement, Social Security retirement is paid, you know, separately from the income tax. But they lump it all in there, and it shows, and when they do it that way, it shows that only 25% is spent on the military versus, you know, the actual 47% if you're just looking at the income tax. So when you break it out and show what the income tax is going, it's clearly closer, you know, much closer to half of the entire income tax revenue stream goes to the military for past or current military spending.
Wow. So you guys in Seattle, I should probably note at this point, if I didn't earlier, that you are the treasurer of the Veterans for Peace chapter down in Seattle, and you are the immediate past president of that group. So we know whereof you speak. And today you had people, not yourself, I understand, but others, passing out these pamphlets. Where was the action?
Well, you're right. I wasn't able to be down there today. I have every year for the past few years. I've been down there, but I have a scheduling conflict today, and I couldn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But we had members at the main branch in the post office in downtown Seattle.
Okay.
We like to get folks as they're coming into the post office to drop those tax returns in. And that's always been a very high traffic area for us on tax day. And this year we had a couple of members down at a post office in Kent, Washington, which is a suburb of Seattle.
Right. Okay.
So that's where folks were today.
Do you get any reaction from people when you hand them this? Is there a sort of, you peaceniks, you have nothing to say to me, we're important, or anything like that?
You know, a few people have that kind of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, most people will just take the leaflets and they're in, you know, if they're interested, they'll take them. A lot of people don't care what you're doing, but, you know, we pass out several hundred in the span of 2 hours that we usually reserve down there during the lunch period. And so several hundred out. So a lot of people do take them. Most people don't really comment. There are always a few people who are hostile. Mm-hmm. And then there's a few, there are usually more people, though, who, you know, understand what we're trying to do and express their appreciation for us. In fact, last year, somebody went into one of the neighboring stores close to where we were handing out the leaflets and bought a $20 gift certificate for us to go in and get some coffee and, and
well, that's nice.
Get warmed up after the being out there last mm-hmm. year. I didn't hear didn't get any reports of that this year, and that was the first time. But yeah, there's always, you know, there's always quite a few people who understand and appreciate what we're doing, what we're trying to raise awareness of, and a few people who are hostile, but never comes to blows or anything like that.
Well, although it displays and sort of substantiates an astounding level of commitment to giving money to our war machine, it doesn't seem to be particularly overtly anti-war. I mean, these are just the facts.
Yeah, and they go to great lengths to, you know, to document it and show where their sources are. The backside of it, though, is, you know, talks a little bit more about that. That's headed up, it says, world's number one employer seeks endless war, and that talks about the Pentagon and compares it to other large institutional employers. It shows that, you know, the Defense Department employs 3.2 million people, whereas the, you know, Walmart employs 2.1 and the Chinese military 2.3. So the point is that the U.S. Defense Department is the largest single employer in the world. And so they go into that and talk about that. And every year they, you know, they change the backside a little bit. Every year the front side is always the pie chart that breaks down the federal income tax outlays. And this year they've done a good job, I think, of talking about, they mentioned a RAND Corporation study of how terrorist groups end. And they brought that in there. I thought that was fairly interesting. It's actually a book-length study on that shows that, you know, most terrorist groups don't end because of military action. You can't wage a war against so-called terrorism. It's funny, you know, when someone else does it, it's terrorism. When the United States kills 10 children in a village in Afghanistan through artillery fire or missile attacks, it's drone attacks, it's not terrorism, But anyways, they make the point that, you know, only 7% of cases did military action end a so-called terrorist threat. So yeah, I mean, it's basically showing what, you know, war is costing us in terms of dollars and cents. Of course, it's keyed into the fact that today's tax day. And
sure.
And then talks about how it distorts our economy and it's, you know, raising awareness of what the, at least as reflected in government spending, what our collective priorities are, and give people an opportunity to think about whether or not those are really the priorities they would have if they felt like they had more say in it, or in how the tax revenues are spent.
Well, it's always sort of confounded me that we have these discussions about the almost bottomless pit that we spend on the military, and yet what gets all the attention when we're talking about paring back the U.S. debt and the deficit is ending earmarks by the Congress, which amounts to like 0.5% of the appropriations, and other things like that are people's pet peeves, but they don't really have much to do with, you know, really addressing the issue of highly inflated spending. I don't know if it's in here, but isn't it, it's fairly well known, I think, that the amount that the United States spends on its military is darn near equal to the rest of the world combined. It's like 48% and includes the military of China, Indian, Russia, Brazil, Chile,
yeah.
Just right down the line, Canada, U.S., U.K., and it just seems like an astounding level of so-called national security when, as we see every day, it doesn't seem to work all that well in making sure that no incursions on our freedom and our liberty and our independence are made. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they don't really cover that topic this year in comparison to, you know, the rest of the world combined, like you say. I think in the past, if I recall, I don't have any of their old charts in front of me, but I think they have had that information on there in the past. Just to go back to the pie chart, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And I think it dovetails in what you were saying. The, you know, a big chunk of the pie is past military spending, as I was saying before. And that, you know, so when people talk about the national debt of the United States, you know, a lot of that is actually driven by past military spending that's accumulated for years. We've been spending half of the federal revenue stream, the income tax stream, is spent on the military, and a lot of that's you know, financed through debt now. The tremendous debt that this country has year after year of spending, so that's building up, so we're paying interest on that, which also adds to the deficit, of course, or the debt rather.
It's also an indication of the fact that at least the two big wars that we're currently engaged in, Afghanistan and Iraq, which we have theoretically wrapped up, but those expenditures were initially reported as off budget. So, and secondly, we had to borrow money to do it because Americans saw absolutely or virtually no change in their standard of living, their taxation level, or anything like that. We just said, well, we can't afford to do this, but we can't afford not to do it. So we're not going to do the politically unpopular thing of making Americans pay for their own war. We're going to go borrow the money from China.
Yeah, China is the largest single holder of America's debt, America's federal debt.
Mm-hmm.
Not the private debt, but the government debt. It's an interesting, who'd have thought, right?
Well, yeah. And now we have North Korea, of all places, you know, sort of terrorizing the area over there and alleging that they're going to start a nuclear war with their one unreliable warhead and their two or three nuclear weapons. And I haven't seen our incredible wealth of military assets get them to act reasonably. So I just, as an aside here for Alaskan people, on May 4th in Anchorage, the Navy is going to be commissioning a brand new ship, and it is a military supply ship for which there is no known use. Excuse me, but they're going to call it the USS Anchorage. And so Anchorage Society is all a Twitter, and there is going to be a ball, and there's going to be receptions for the officers, and it's going to be a great big deal. But, you know, here in Juneau last fall, we dedicated a park to the name of Bishop Michael Kenney, who was a Roman Catholic bishop in Juneau between, I think it was 1975 and 1995, when he died an unhappy and untimely death. But one of the, I'll never forget this, is one of the things that he did in his capacity as an American, with the added authority, of course, of the priesthood and the bishopric, he led a protest against naming a Trident submarine after the state of Alaska. He said, you know, if we might need these things, but we ought to paint them gray and just put a number on them. Why should we put an instrument, put the name of a land we love on an instrument of war? And he raised a lot of consciousness. He, of course, we still have a Trident submarine running around carrying Alaska's name, but it was a very powerful statement. And I guess where I'm going with this is that the military, I think, does an absolutely brilliant job of organizing support in the public mind and everything else. I mean, nobody comes back from a military operation without being called a hero, no matter what they may have done. So I'm going to start winding myself down. I sort of get too excited about these things. But
well,
go ahead.
It's interesting, Phil, the story you were telling about the bishop, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, who was... I happened to be reading today a paper, an article that was published in a scholarly journal called Modern Theology, and the title of the article was called Killing for the Telephone Company, Why the Nation State is Not the Keeper of the Common Good. And he's likening, the author of the articles is comparing, you know, the way that the government functions is really a telephone company. It's a huge nameless institution that really isn't in the business of serving people so much as it is keeping itself going and making money. And one of the things that the author talks about is how nation states, how governments are really good at creating a culture and taking over society and really shaping and molding society. And he makes a really interesting argument about that. And I think, you know, what you were saying about the balls and the naming of the ships after the states and the celebratory atmosphere about it, that's all part of building a culture, you know, where it gets the people of this country to identify not only with the government but with the military, which is, you know, the armed branch of the government. So it's really about a culture and building a society of values around those values of basically violence, the violence that's at the heart, the fundamental feature of the government is violence, as Gandhi said, actually. Gandhi said back in 1935, Gandhi said that the state represents violence in a concentrated and organized form. The individual has a soul, but the state is a soulless machine. It can never be weaned from violence to which it owes its very existence. So he really had the insight to that deep connection, you know, between the idea of the state or the government and the violence that's at the root of the whole idea of it, and how that builds a whole culture. But I was just reminded of that when you mentioned the...
No, I appreciate that. And that that's, of course, what we're trying to do in our little way, the Veterans for Peace, trying to plug the hole in the dike with our fingers, because there's that enormous pressure behind the current culture and the cultural violence and so forth. And, of course, that extends to automatic weapons and all kinds of things that are sort of overtaking a lot of the consciousness of our community, really. And also, you know, kids and guns and kids and places that are available to show that might makes right, and sort of a coarsening of our society. And I think we have to fight back against that in a nonviolent way, but it certainly is a challenge.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to do is have everybody who's been listening and who is interested in this pie chart and the information with it, is to give them the number or the URL, the website for this outfit. It's warresistors.org. Very simple.
Yep.
War Resistors, two words made into one, .org. And I know it works because I went there today and I looked and there's a pie chart. And I'm glad you sent me the copy that you have, though, because it appears to be much easier to read than the copy I was looking at. But anyway, it's fascinating. And I really appreciate your taking the time to talk about it.
All right. You're welcome. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. The other thing do you want to close out with or add or?
Well, just to talk about you mentioned the VFP. I'll just add, I've been thinking a lot about the kind of work that we're doing in Veterans for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the peace movement more generally. And the more I think about it, I think that, you know, it would really be good if we fundamentally rethought the whole idea of how violence is rooted in government itself. So a lot of times we try to lobby government to be less violent and mm-hmm. less war and less peaceful, and we seem to not have an awareness that that's what governments do. And if your readers or your listeners, rather, are interested, there's a really good article. It's a classic article called War Making and State Making as Organized Crime by Charles Hilly. That's really a classic on this that really lays it out how violence is really built in. And if we want to, so the point being that, you know, if we want to be effective peacemakers, we have to not be appealing to institutions and people who've made themselves part of institutions that have violence really built into them, that it's in the very nature mm-hmm. of the institution of government to use violence. That's what governments do. And, you know, the ones that are really good at it become superpowers like the United States, mm-hmm. and the rest of them just kind of go along like minor gangsters on the planet. They go along or else they get crushed.
Well, that's we can't do that in the next 2 minutes. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That was it.
I really appreciate that because it's very true, and we need to understand that real peace begins within us and in our families and in our communities and in our states and then in our nation. And it cannot be violent. So we're working on that, but it's not going to be something that I'm going to enjoy before I trot off the other end. So, well, Michelle, I'm going to wrap this up right now once again to thank you, Michelle Kanyukin, for your insights and your wisdom, and to let the people know that they can get copies of this chart and a lot of other information at the website for the War Resistors League, which is www.warresistors.org. And with that, I think we'll play a little interlude music and ask you to come back in a few, and we'll be talking to Brian Doherty and his friend, Hattie, from Lebanon. So let's take a break now. Thanks, Michelle.
Yep, bye. Thank you.
Oh, let's go.
So thank you very much. This is a good time to remind everybody that you are listening to KTOO in fair Juneau, where we've had two or three days of great weather, and that's sort of bubbled up everybody's joy and presence until today when we had it, sort of the wind taken out of our sails. But let us proceed now, and I'd very much like to welcome Brian Daugherty, who is a host parent for the YES program, sponsored by the U.S. State Department, and Hattie Kanj.
With a J.
I'm very sorry.
Oh, no mind.
You know, who is a student, a hosted student, and he is from Lebanon. So I guess for starters, I would like to ask Brian, what is the YES program, and what are you doing with it? I mean, how do you be a host parent for the YES program?
The YES program, as you said, is run by the State Department, and their mission is to invite youth from all over the world, really, but often areas of conflict, to come to the United States and just live here for a year and get to know what the United States is. You know, that it's a very unique society on the planet. And their idea, and they do a lot of screening, they're very careful. The YES program is very competitive. Hattie, do you remember how many students applied?
About 30,000.
Yeah, 30,000 students apply, and they take about 800. And so it's quite competitive. And they're looking for students who have a profile that indicate that they may become civic or business leaders in the future and just have greater knowledge of what the West is and be able to communicate or bring ideas back to their home countries. So it's really seeding international understanding. And when I heard about it, I was really excited about it. I thought that was really a worthwhile program, and right away signed up and said, yeah, I'd like to have a student. And I've enjoyed every minute of it, to tell you the truth.
Now, we've done this in Juneau for the last two or three years, where we've had students?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm gonna add that the YES program brings students from countries that have a significant Muslim population.
Okay.
Because their goal is to make the relationships between the Muslims and the Muslims and the Americans better, especially after what happened after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, this program was started after 9/11.
Yeah.
And it was an initiative from Senator Kennedy, right?
Yeah, and Lugar.
And Lugar, right. Yeah. Huh. And, well, let's ask you some questions then. So you're from Lebanon.
Yes.
And you were one of 30,000 people who applied
to
be part of this. And you were selected as one of the 800 who were put in the program. And what particular skills or background or whatever do you think earned you the placement as a YES student? I mean, other than you speak English very well.
I mean, we're 800 students in the U.S., and I'm one of them. And, I mean, I don't know, they would look at your leadership skills, if you're comfortable to be in another country, another home, living for a year by yourself, social skills. Of course, English, and yeah, they ask you a lot of questions, they interview you, and yeah, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Good grades,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some smarts.
Yeah.
And I suppose your parents are probably interviewed as well.
Yeah.
And
they're asked about me and if I can handle myself without my parents, without them. Yeah.
And they probably said yes. So what do your parents do?
My mom and my dad are both gynecologists.
Oh, okay.
But my dad is not working as a gynecologist now. He owns a company.
And you live in Lebanon or?
Yeah, in Beirut.
In Beirut, okay. So is the tension over there difficult to live with? I mean, there's, you know, Syria and Iraq for all these years, and of course a constant conflict around the edge of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of wars, and there's always problems, but it's not as bad as it looks, you know. Mm-hmm. And also, but now after what's happening in Syria, it's there's a lot of refugees coming from Syria, and that's making a lot of problems, especially in the north, between the people who are with the Syrian president and people who are against. So they are shifting some of the fights to Lebanon.
So there's a danger of the Syrian civil war, really, spilling over and involving Lebanon, probably on both sides.
Yeah, and also like Lebanon and Syria are really close, like they are brothers as countries. And so whatever happens in Lebanon or in Syria would affect the other country. And even in Lebanon, there's Lebanese people who are with the Syrian president and other Lebanese people who are against. Yeah.
So do you think the U.S. ought to step into that mess?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I don't see how there's anything that we can do as a nation to.
Yeah.
Except make it worse.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah.
Because it could be one-sided. And as a U.S., it would give the one-sided resolution.
Right.
And a lot of people in Syria are with the president and would have won that. So a political solution between the two sides would be the best.
Do you see any movement in that direction where the people do want to sit down and do want to try to work this out, or are they still having their temper tantrums?
They're still having their temper.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
well, it's just one of the sad things we have to live with for a while.
Yeah.
But I mean, anyway, then you won, not won, but you were accepted into this program, which was a hell of an achievement just all by itself. And then you came to America.
Yeah.
And what? And when was that? And what?
I arrived to Washington, D.C. the 7th of August.
Okay.
And then we stayed there for like 3 days. And then I came to, you know.
That all 800 of you there at the same time?
No.
Oh.
We were like, I don't know, 200, I guess.
Okay, so they cycle them through.
Yeah.
And then they put you on an airplane, and you got here, and there's Dean, and it's been lovely ever since.
Yeah.
Where are you going to school?
JDHS.
At JD, and what is your status in school? Are you a senior?
Junior.
Junior, okay. Yeah. Have you enjoyed the classes and the people?
Yeah. The students are great, and the classes are really cool.
Has the academics, I don't know how to say this, because I'm not really criticizing the Juno schools, but are the academics as rigorous as you experienced in your school in Lebanon?
No, I mean, they're much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you go to a special school in Lebanon? In other words, we have a public high school, anybody who walks through the door is educated, or is at least attends class and can graduate. And in some countries, I know that they track kids, like after the sixth grade or something, and they say, okay, well, you're never going to be a pediatrician, so we're going to train you to drive tanks, or we're going to, you know, move you into a different school where a lower set of skills are taught. Not, I don't mean lowered in the sense that they're lesser. I mean, just not as intellectually
more
challenging.
More hands-on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in a private school in Lebanon.
In Lebanon, yeah.
But like 70% of the students in Lebanon are in private schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I don't know. There's a lot of people who are in private schools. And most people go to college also, so.
So that would explain at least some difference between the two systems.
Yeah.
But you're getting along fine with all the kids here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you encountering any, I'm sorry, Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that in Lebanon that Hattie goes to a Christian Baptist school, even though the majority of the students in the school are Muslim.
So is that a bother? I mean, is it?
No, not at all.
Does it handicap you in any way, or no. Do you feel? Are you under pressure to go to a Sharia school, or is that the right question? I mean, there are Muslim schools for Muslim people and students, and isn't that what they call the Sharia?
No, I mean, no, no.
Okay.
They wouldn't call the school a Sharia. I don't think so.
Okay.
But, I mean, no, it doesn't. I mean, I'm Muslim and I go to a Christian school. And there's some Christians who would go to other schools. So
I bring it up because one of the impressions that many of us have, and I, including myself, before I met Hattie and got to learn about Lebanon and the political situation in the Mideast, is that we tend to boil things down to Shia-Sunni conflicts,
mm-hmm.
and you find that it's really a lot more complex. Lebanon particularly has a large Druze and Christian,
mm-hmm.
Sunni and Shia, and that political parties are made up of all these elements. And so I know in discussions that I've had here that like myself, many people just, you know, boil it down to these two factions. So I brought up his going to a Christian school just because it reveals right away the complexity, you know, of other societies that you might not be aware of.
Well, I think that's very true. I mean, that's why we have these types of exchange programs, is to blow away stereotypes and,
exactly.
and to open the doors and the minds to understanding and.
And that is exactly what happens,
mm-hmm.
with the Yes Grant program on both parts, the host family and the student,
mm-hmm.
in that you really are from different places in the world. It really is an exchange program. It's very different than getting a kid from Northern Europe, let's say, that comes to the U.S., and the differences are pretty minor. But if you've come from a country that is often at conflict or from the Mideast, you know, you're coming from a pretty different angle on the universe. And it's been really interesting, you know, truly an interesting exchange. And not to compare exchange programs or students, but we've had three, and I've enjoyed them all. But this has been definitely the most interesting and thought-provoking exchange, where I feel like I've really grown from it.
Well, let me ask Hattie, do you feel that you've grown from it?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, what did you expect when you got on that airplane in Lebanon and flew to the U.S.?
What did I expect about Alaska or
the
United States?
About
the
United States and then about Alaska and everything. Just, I mean, was it, did it comport with your thinking about what it would be like or?
I mean, if I came to Alaska directly, it wouldn't have been this, I mean, the same idea that I had. But because I went down south, and then there I saw that, yes, this is probably what I knew the United States would be. Because a lot of people do know what the United States is. But they don't know, I mean, they know what's only visible in the movies. They don't know what happens in in each family and how the parents react. And I mean, one of the significant things that I found when I came here is there's some places that are there's poverty in the U.S. There's people who don't have. There's homeless people. It's not like all houses are advanced. All everything is perfectly done, as one would think. And yeah.
So your perception was, or could have been, that America serves this little cocoon of comfort and wealth, and
yeah.
And in fact, it's a real place with real poverty
and
serious
problems.
Social problems of
yeah.
our own. Yeah,
that's true.
Is there a general perception with your classmates in Lebanon and others that the United States is just a big bully?
Yes, the government.
The government, not excuse me.
Not necessarily the people.
Excuse me. And is that resented particularly, or?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if when I was your age, which is a long time ago, I guess my question would have been, if somebody offered me a trip to the Soviet Union, and, you know, during the 1950s, when I was your age, that was considered, oh, my God, you know, they're terrible, godless people, and all they want to do is kill all the Americans, and, you know, we were trading threats of nuclear war, and we had spies, and they had spies, and, you know, we just had this total blackout, though, on what real people are like and how really nice they were, and how if we met them, we'd get along just fine. Yeah. But we had these stereotypes built up partly by our government to justify these huge military expenditures we've been talking about, but also partly by people's imagination and, a sphere, and, I mean, the churches were involved, and we just sort of built a whole culture of anti-Soviet thought. But I still believe, having, you know, subsequently been to Russia, there's some amazingly wonderful people there. And having been there and having served in the army, you know, our army in France, the idea of waging war against one of those countries just seems the furthest thing in the world from anything I'd want to do.
Yeah.
And that's because I've had opportunities to meet people, to be with them, to be with them here. And it's just sort of an increase in friendship and an acceptance of differences. But so it would seem that these exchange programs are particularly valuable in easing tensions. And, you know, a young guy from Juneau says, well, shit, you know, excuse me, we can't bomb Beirut. I've got a friend there.
Yeah.
You know, his parents are physicians. You know, and I would think that would be some of the value of this.
Yeah, I mean, before I came here, my dad told me not to discuss political issues here. Because he thought that all the Americans would have one view about, for example, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and all these wars, and whatever issues in the Middle East. And he told me not to discuss political issues, but when I came here, there's a lot of people that that you can share your thoughts with, and they would accept it, and you probably have the same thoughts with them. So that's part of what I'm going to tell my parents and my friends back home, that it's not that all Americans would hate the Arabs, or would have this idea and wouldn't have different and diverse ideas about the Middle East.
So you're going to go back?
Yeah.
We can't keep you.
We'd like to. But
right, I'll bet. So your plan is then you're the equivalent of a junior in America. and you'll leave next spring.
Yeah.
I mean, in a couple of months, I guess.
2 months.
Yeah, and then you're going to fly back to Lebanon and resume your life.
Yeah.
And then what are your academic plans?
I'm going to finish my senior year back home, and I'm going to go to college, probably in Beirut.
Okay.
But I don't know if I'm going to come back and study here.
Mm-hmm. What interests you for a career and
business?
Business?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just international business or?
Yeah, an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Not a little shop down on the corner.
No.
You want your own Learjet.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. So do you have brothers and sisters there?
Yeah.
Are they going to apply to be in the program? And
oh, they're older than me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm the only one who applied.
Yeah. So, and you would recommend this program to,
yeah,
to your friends back there. And this works both ways, doesn't it? Where kids can,
yes,
Americans, yeah. I mean, it's exchange.
It is an exchange, and American kids can go to anywhere that Yes Grant is represented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also Hattie a number of times has mentioned the Yes Grant alumni as being an active group in Lebanon, which is interesting to me. I haven't heard a whole lot about it yet, but I don't know if they have meetings or whether they. How have you interacted with them, Hattie, or heard about them?
Yeah, I mean. I've been to orientations before I came here, and when I went to DC, and they also mentioned that our exchange doesn't stop now, doesn't stop when at the end of the year, and it's not the end now because there's these alumni that share the same experience that you have, and that are constantly working on social issues and trying to serve the community by fundraising and raising awareness about different topics and issues.
That's great. Sort of has popped into my brain, excuse me for not being glib, but is there sort of an effort made with some unifying vision, for instance, music or sports or something that these groups are tie into America, or is it really just individual and the experience you have is the one you make? That's not a very good question, is it?
I think that it's individual.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a theme to who they accept or who applies or an overall umbrella other than what we described earlier coming in. Being a bright person and just learning about American society. I've gotten the impression from Hattie, we took a trip down to Portland and elsewhere, and I remember once he came home and said, oh my gosh, there's all kinds of Saudis here. He'd go out and he'd hear Arabic being spoken.
Mm.
And I know I had a very memorable conversation where we just started talking about American society and that the fact that it's a global society.
Mm-hmm.
And how unique this is on the planet, and that as our demographics change, you know, American politics change. And I think that when you come from homogeneous societies, ancient societies, I mean, Lebanon is this ancient place. And, you know, you can go to France or Europe or Asia or whatever, and there's these ancient cultures. And you come here, and America is fundamentally acultural, something different.
Mm-hmm.
All cultures are welcome. There's, did you tell me 2 million Lebanese in the U.S.?
There's three.
3 million.
Three or four.
Wow.
Yeah, and that that's nearly the population of Beirut, which has the majority of the population of Lebanon. So you start to see what Americans' relationship is with Lebanon. It's something, the relationship's stronger than you might realize.
Yeah, I mean, every Lebanese person has relatives in the U.S., I would tell you. I have this friend and this relative in Michigan.
And there are several other nationalities that are strong. Well, yeah. Mexican, Cuban, et cetera. So
thousands of nationalities.
Right. And it's, well, I think there were over 100 countries represented in the Boston Marathon today.
Yeah. Well,
those,
I think
when those bombs went off.
When the World Trade Centers came down, there were 280 or over 200 nationalities that lost citizens.
Well, I think we're about at the end of our time. I would like to suggest that perhaps if we had more programs like the YES program, we would have fewer events like 9/11. So just a couple minutes now. Maybe you could wrap us up and tell us how to become a YES parent and
what your
experience is. Go ahead.
I know that the YES grant representatives who are Rich Moniak, and I don't have his telephone number right off the bat, and Judy Meyer, who can be contacted at 789-9229, are currently looking, right now, are looking for host families for YES Grant students. And I can't encourage people enough, if they're at all interested in having an exchange student, to talk to Judy and Rich and learn more about this program, because it's really been powerful and good. I can't say enough about it.
Well, I appreciate your time, Hattie, in particular.
Thanks.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And enjoy your next couple of months, and then have a lovely trip home, and thank you again.
Take care, gentlemen.
Thank you, Pat.
Phil. So this is Phil Smith with Veterans for Peace, bringing to a close this week's edition of Peace Talk. Have a good evening, and remember, wage peace.